A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 209. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of City Beneath the Sea and Secret Beneath the Sea. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
So these were two black and white children's adventure serials from ITV that broadcast in 1962 and 1963, a total of 13 25-minute episodes.
That's right. And it's similar in theme and tone to the Pathfinders in Space series that we've previously discussed. Many of the same cast and crew. As we'll talk about in a minute, it shares sort of similar themes of children's adventure serials, but also with some educational content. There's quite a bit of science in there. And as we said, many of the same actors. So it's quite familiar if you've seen the black and white series, Pathfinders in Space.
Yes, it's all but in name a continuation of the Pathfinders set of serials. In this case, rather than doing space adventures, they're doing undersea adventures. And we have the two lead actors in very similar characters. So they're not actually the same people that went up into space earlier, but it's a very similar type of show.
Yes, we could pause and wonder why they didn't just continue with the same character names. But anyway, as you say, this decision was to introduce new characters who were very similar to the Pathfinders ones with similar jobs. And in Gerald Flood and Stuart Godotti, similar, you know, the same actors again. So last time we talked about City Beneath the Sea, which was the first 7 episodes. So straight on to the sequel, as indeed did the cast and crew. Secret Beneath the Sea, this time 6 episodes. And the first episode begins with the book launch for Mark Bannerman's book, which is indeed called City Beneath the Sea. And that allows for a useful recap of the events of the first serial, Brian.
Yes, I thought that was quite clever, actually, that they introduced this idea that the main character, who was a journalist, had written a book about the previous adventure, and it lets us set things up moving on from that. We have the introduction of a new teenage character who is also interested in science. Her name is Janet, played by Ingrid Sylvester. And she sort of fills out that group of main characters and the group of our heroes. Mark and Peter receive this mysterious disc made of an unidentifiable metal, and their investigations soon lead them back to the Siana, the very same submarine from the first serial, which is once again headed for the underwater city of Egeria. Although this time it's a legitimate mission to Egeria, which is now controlled by the British Navy and has become a legitimate international center of scientific investigation.
Yes, that's right. And we've got this character we mentioned last time, Captain Payne of the British Navy, who's now in charge both of Siana and, it seems, of this international operation in Egeria. So, yeah, the City Beneath the Sea, now a much more reputable place. And as you say, there's this mysterious disc of metal, which everybody seems to want. So there's lots of people trying to get hold of it. Underwater, there's a new experimental mining process, and there seems to be sabotage going on to try and slow it down. And it's all to do, we learn, with this new wondrous metal, which is called phoenicium. It takes its name from the powers of the phoenix, because we're told several times that it is incredibly resistant to transmitting heat. So they show us, I think, several times, Brian, this same experiment of a Bunsen burner firing on one side of this disc of metal, and various scientists and journalists being able to place their hand on the other side and feel it's cool. So quite remarkable properties this fictional metal has.
Yes, and just in case we've forgotten, they show us that exact demonstration a number of times.
Yes, with this one same disc of metal. But we're told it's very important, that a lot of people want to get hold of it, and that if they could produce significant amounts of it, it would be very helpful in space exploration, because it would mean they would have to they would have a much more efficient heat shield for re-entry. And we're told that a few times as well.
Yes, and we're introduced to sort of corporate villains in this one, where we have a businessman who is trying to take over the mining for Phoenicium and to sort of drive out the international project on Egeria, so he could have this monopoly over this incredibly important metal rather than having it be an open international type of thing.
Yes, as you say, the corporate, this businessman is introduced in the early episodes, and who I thought was going to become another sort of Bond-style villain for the rest of the show. But after we found out what he's after, we don't really see him again. We do meet a sort of old enemy or a familiar character from the first series will crop up again in a different sort of or in a different role to how he was portrayed in the first series. But it's the same character. But then again, I suppose later on we'll find out that the true villain, well, there's a surprise coming out. Let's put it that way, shall we, Brian?
Yes. So they filmed on the same sets that they had used in City Beneath the Sea, with more or less the same cast and crew, and used the same title music. The production basically went straight from one serial into the next, so it was almost like one big production block for both serials.
Yes, I can't quite remember, but I think Pathfinders in Space did the same, of having very similar title sequences. But here, as you say, Brian, the two title sequences are just more or less identical, apart from the actual title.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Pathfinders in Space, as they went on, it became more and more a continuation. You know, the last two serials, you know, they were up in space and then continued right on. The same people were up in space at basically the same time. It was like a direct continuation.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the science content and this idea of children's adventure serials with their educational content. We know from history that's something that Sidney Newman was always very keen on. He wanted to deliver space science in the Pathfinder series. He wanted to deliver some underwater exploration stuff here. And we know that when he got to the BBC, one of his main aims for Doctor Who was that it would be an educational programme about history. And we know, obviously, that perhaps didn't quite go the way he intended. But there you go. So here we have, in these two underwater adventures, we've got lots of stuff about radios. We've got quite a bit about the hazards of deep sea diving, the various effects that pressure can have on the divers and the underwater vessels. But we've also got atomic energy, and we've got, particularly in the first series, the dangers and the threat of nuclear weapons. So there's quite a lot of stuff delivered at various points by scientists as a sort of educational package as well, Brian.
Yes, that's right. It's actually not bad at doing that. I think probably these serials do that a little bit better than the Pathfinders serials did. But they certainly, all of these certainly look at doing that. And in these ones, there was also a little bit of sort of geopolitical things that they put in there, with the ideas about in the first one about, you know, knowledge being very powerful, and if one person has this great knowledge that no one else does, that that can be dangerous, and wanting to make it more open and international. And then in this one, it gets into these sort of ideas with mining rights, and if something is commercial and a monopoly, what happens then? And if it's a more open international thing, what happens in that case? So there's quite a bit with that. And as you say, a lot with the science of the nuclear things and the underwater issues and radio and that sort of thing as well. And it's certainly true that Sidney Newman was very big on including these educational things. And that was true in Doctor Who with things like Marco Polo on Doctor Who, where they were putting in some history there. And the original cast of Doctor Who included someone playing a science teacher and someone playing a history teacher. And they were very much trying to work little science and history lessons into the early episodes. And that is something we see in a slightly different way here as well. So it's interesting to see that.
Yes, and as you say, Brian, probably delivered slightly better in these underwater serials than in the space ones. Perhaps because it's a slightly more believable setup. I think having Bannerman and Blake have jobs which actually takes them on board the submarine legitimately makes more sense. I suppose it's quite predictable that Peter Blake will actually get into trouble quite a lot and need rescuing at the end of episodes, or rather at the start of the next episode. But that's the format, I think, isn't it? He's quite good at getting himself into trouble when he's nosing around.
Yes, absolutely. That is sort of a classic 1960s tune in next week cliffhanger type of thing, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But as I say, he does have an actual job and he does have an actual interest in radio and the science that goes with it. So it's slightly more believable than the professors, the rocket scientists, nephews and nieces sort of blundering their way on board a spaceship, which then takes off, which we had in Target Luna.
Yes. So I think this takes us neatly into our sort of look at the good and the bad of our own opinions on this. We've started into that a bit. So what did you like about City Beneath the Sea and Secret Beneath the Sea, Eamon?
Well, I think we do have to keep in mind that these are children's shows. These are children's tea time adventure serials from the early years of ITV. But in that context, let's start with the writing. It's not bad. I think John Lucarotti does a pretty good job. Maybe as it is this slightly more plausible scenario than the Pathfinder series, that we can believe Bannerman and Blake actually are on board the submarine and get into a lot of trouble and find their ways out of it. So the writing of the show, for early 60s children's stuff, not bad at all, I thought, Brian. What would you say?
I think that's fair. The writing is pretty reasonable. And I think the way that they included these sort of science type ideas there and the sort of political and economic kinds of things combined, I thought that was quite nicely done. And I think that was an improvement over the Pathfinder series, wherein Pathfinders, really, they could only talk about space travel and the sort of limited things that they knew about space travel at the time, where with this, they were able to talk about these underwater things of diving and the like, and they were able to talk about sort of political kinds of things. They were able to talk about the nuclear issues. They had a lot of things that they knew a lot about that were sort of big, well-established topics. So I think they had better material to work with on the sort of science and educational end of things than they did in Pathfinders.
Yeah. Okay. What about the performances, Brian? What would you think of the acting in these two shows?
Well, they were okay. There were not really any standout performances that I thought were really very strong. I think the leads were not bad. You know, Gerald Flood does a pretty reasonable job with what he's given, which is not a lot, but I think he does an okay job with it. And the same thing with some of the other actors in it. I think Dennis Gocher as Kurt Svendler, while he does sort of a bit of a silly German accent, his character sort of grows a bit over time, and I thought that was not bad. Some of the others were sort of either bland, or, you know, Aubrey Morris as Professor Zebrecken I thought was not that great, but, you know, it was sort of a bit of a mixed bag. But, you know, on the whole, it was sort of okay, I guess.
Okay. I mean, certainly for children's shows, I thought it was pretty good. I do like Gerald Flood. He's got a very sort of watchable screen persona. He's got that suave, sort of calm intelligence that he portrays. He sort of reminds me of Gerald Harper from Adam Adamant in perhaps his look and his sort of his manner.
I could see that.
But he's very watchable. Yes. You also, I think you noticed, Brian, a minor acting role from a chap who would go on to be famous for something else related to Doctor Who.
Oh, yes. Barry Letts is in this. He is sort of the assistant to the naval captain in the first serial, In City Beneath the Sea. He shows up in probably two or three episodes of it, and it's not a very big part, but it's certainly a bit of a presence there, and it's neat to see him there from when he was still acting before he went on to direction and then production. And of course, he's best known to us for being the producer of Doctor Who in the early 1970s when John Pertwee was the third Doctor. And he directed many Doctor Who serials starting in the late 60s, and he wrote some as well. So it is neat to see him here as an actor.
Okay, interesting stuff there. We talked briefly in the last episode about the special effects, the sets, the model work, which we thought was pretty good for the period. Obviously, it looks a little bit creaky now, but at the time, I think it would have been pretty good. And of course, we've got the sequences where they don wetsuits and venture out through an airlock to do some underwater sequences. Filmed, I suppose, in a similar manner to the spacewalk sequences from the Pathfinders films, with actors sort of moving around slowly as if they were underwater. And they have this predictable trick of filming behind a double glass, which could be filled up with water. So we sort of see the airlock filling up with water, and then the actors venturing outside. So that works all right, I think, Brian.
It's definitely the weak point visually in these serials. You know, that it doesn't look as good as the underwater things where they just have the submarines or the interior sets and that sort of thing. But considering when it's coming from, it's not bad.
Okay. There's, I suppose there's a fair amount of stock footage in there as well, particularly the shots of naval ships and then also of some city sequences, both home and abroad. So there's quite, I suppose, you know, again, we would expect a fair amount of stock footage, I guess.
Yeah, and given that this was in black and white and it's from this era, I think those things integrated into it more smoothly than things sometimes would a little later.
Okay. Anything else on the plus side that you wanted to mention about these shows, Brian?
Well, you know, one of the big risks in these kinds of shows is the performances of the teenage actors you're putting in them, because that's always a tough one, finding young actors who can bring it off. And the two that we had in here, Stuart Guadotti and Ingrid Sylvester, were okay. They were not spectacular, and it wasn't at the level we'd get for some of the things in the 70s, like Time Slip and so on, but they were okay.
Yes, okay. They, as you say, they're not bad. I suppose it does take us, in a way, to one of the downsides, which is when we mention the teenage sidekicks, who obviously are supposed to be the identifying part for the audience who's watching, that they can identify with these teenagers. They do get into trouble an awful lot, don't they, Brian? They do tend to end up a lot of episodes in danger as the cliffhanger at the end of each 25 minutes.
Yes, and that, I would say, is one of the weak points of this, is they have to sort of force the cliffhangers, and often they do involve those two characters. Those characters are sort of both the strength and the weakness of this show. You know, they are good because they're, you know, fairly decent as actors, and the things they give them to do are fairly plausible, but they're also a bit of a drawback because of these things where they have to keep getting in trouble, and because while they're reasonable actors, they're not as strong as some of the adults are.
Yes. And it didn't seem to be such a problem with early Doctor Who, this sort of desperate need to conjure up a easily resolvable cliffhanger every 25 minutes. It is much more noticeable in these shows, I think.
Yes, Doctor Who did have the sort of capture, release, recapture things that would give you cliffhangers sometimes. And there were some things with that, but they were able to manage it and pull it off a little better, I think. And I think with Doctor Who, when you had more adult characters, it helped, because you had, certainly in some cases in the early years of Doctor Who, you had some actors in there who could help bring it off. When you had people like William Russell and Jaclyn Hill there, for example.
Yes, okay. As you say, a step up probably in terms of writing and performances to that show. And it is quite a step, I guess, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that these types of shows remind me of, and Pathfinder certainly did as well, is how big a step forward it was when Doctor Who came out. For television that was aimed at children, you know, beforehand, you had these types of things that could be okay, but they were very much sort of simple adventure pieces that were aimed at children. Well, Doctor Who was sort of new in that it was aimed at adults as well as children. It was sort of family viewing. And in terms of the performances, and in many cases, the writing, it was sort of a dramatic step into doing something more interesting and more complicated, as you see to a certain extent in the first episode of Doctor Who, and then you'd see that more so in the Daleks, and by the time Doctor Who does the serial The Aztecs in 1964, they were really doing some interesting and involved things with their storylines and their characters and so on. And the distance from Secret Beneath the Sea to the Aztecs is enormous, even though you're only looking at something like a year between the two.
Okay, so as you say, remarkable progress once we get to something like Doctor Who. But we do have City Beneath the Sea and Secret Beneath the Sea surviving. It's nice that they're in the archive. It's nice that we've had them on a good DVD release. The quality is pretty good. I think there's a couple of dodgy moments of tape, kind of thought, but on the whole, they look very sharp and even slightly better, I thought, than the Pathfinders reproduction. So it's nice to have them. I guess it brings us to a question, which is going to take us into our own recommendations about the contrast between the two series. Pathfinders in Space, the box set over here, is currently about £17. as opposed to this box set that we've been looking at, which over here in the UK is £13. And I'm starting to think and starting to wonder, Brian, which we would recommend to our listeners if we were only going to recommend one.
Well, it's an interesting question. Of course, the Pathfinder's box set, a little more expensive. It also gives you more. There are three serials in that one. But it is an interesting question. Both of these are very much a slice of history, and they're fantastic in those terms to be able to see that slice of history. And I'm leaning towards, in terms of the historical and sort of academic looking at things, that Pathfinders gives you a more interesting slice of things because of the progress they make and the changes they make over the course of those three serials. In terms of the actual quality of the stories and which one is a more enjoyable watch, I think these Undersea Adventures are better.
Okay. And if you if we get into our recommendations, what would you say to our viewers in general about the City Beneath the Sea set? Is it something that they should try and get hold of?
Interesting question. If you want to get into sort of seeing what kinds of things were around and see that slice of history and see Gerald Flood as a younger, you know, sort of lead actor, it's an interesting one to take a look at. But just as something on its own to look at for enjoyment, while it's not bad, I don't think I would recommend it because there are other things that are more interesting. I think from this era, I would lean towards more adult types of things that were produced in the 1960s, like A for Andromeda, and also Undermined. And if you're thinking more in terms of the more children's-oriented television, well, there's a lot of great stuff in early Doctor Who that's sort of a similar era, only a little bit later. So just as a piece on its own, I don't think I would recommend this.
Okay. I quite enjoyed this particular box set, and I think if I had to get the choice between this one and Pathfinders, I probably would go for this one because of the slightly more believable setup. And I think also it's clear that in terms of only a year or so later, that the quality of production was improving all the time. It is, as you say, Brian, it's perhaps an acquired taste. You have to have an interest in this early history of television and of children's television in particular. So you have to have an appetite for this black and white stuff and for children's adventure serials. So it's perhaps not for everyone. There are, as you say, lots of other much more interesting shows from the early 60s around, and you've mentioned some very good examples. So it's a cautious recommendation from us here on British Invaders. But as ever, if you disagree with us, if you feel that we've perhaps got it wrong and we should give more importance to these City Beneath the Sea shows, then do get in touch and let us know.
Absolutely. I would love to hear more about what other people think of these. I also think it's worth mentioning that in these particular shows, as compared to Pathfinders, the sort of building in of some of these sort of geopolitical kinds of things and more almost moral issues with using leftover technology from the Nazis and that sort of thing, I think those things really bring it to a cut above what was done on the Pathfinders series.
Okay, interesting stuff.
And we've hinted at this, but it's worth mentioning that at this point, with these rather early shows, the difference in quality between children's television and more adult television was enormous. It becomes much narrower later on, you know, in the late 60s and into the 70s especially. But at this point, there was a big gulf between what was being done for children and what was being done for adults.
Yes, quite a gap, as you say, Brian.
So, in summary, City Beneath the Sea and then Secret Beneath the Sea brought us an undersea adventure series with journalist Mark Bannerman and his assistant and sometime photographer Peter Blake going on an adventure to this underwater city called Egeria, which is introduced as this relic from the Nazis and is first being used by this strange German character who is trying to develop these new things in science and possibly share them with the world or possibly use them as something very powerful for himself. And it is then later used by the British government and the governments of the world for science, but then there may be a bid to do something else from commercial interests. And all the while, our journalist heroes have to figure out what is going on and save the day.
Interesting stuff from early children's television on ITV. And as ever, if you've seen it, let us know what you think.
Absolutely. And it's a classic slice of history of children's TV. And a fairly different one from Pathfinders, especially the first Pathfinders in Space. There was quite a progression over these stories.
Okay. And please come back and join us next time when we are sticking with ITV and covering a show called Astronauts. And it's that tricky area of science fiction comedy, Brian. This is from the 1980s, and it's produced by two of the famous British comedy team, the Goodies. So it's a good pedigree, but we'll find out whether or not they'll pull it off, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. Another dip into space comedy for us here, which, as you say, is always a tricky little area. So before then, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. Also, please join in the discussions on our Facebook group. We have lots of different discussions about the things that we are covering or about to cover, and about Doctor Who, and about audio dramas from Big Finish, and about a whole variety of things that we enjoy and that our listeners enjoy. So it's a fun little community for us there.
Yes, and also stop by and take part in the community at the Voice of Geeks Network, vognetwork.com, internet streaming radio channels with several geek-related podcasts there, and a community to join in. So wherever you can find us, do come along and take part.
Yes, absolutely. We have a Monday evening broadcast slot and a Tuesday evening broadcast slot. The two set up for different time zones, which is nice. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thanks as ever for being with us, and until next time, it's Eamon in England going glump, 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 glump.